Well, good morning. What is this strange moisture coming out of the sky? Anyone figure that out yet? Because we sure haven't seen much of it here in the past more than a month. Little bit of rain over Florida's capital city and South Georgia and the surrounding environs, and that is certainly good for the plants and certainly also good for the aquifer, which we don't want to be putting under too much stress as we go through this hot summer here. Good morning. Welcome to Perspectives on WFSU Public Media. Tom Flanagan with you as always, or most of the time anyway. And before we begin, a reminder, you are always invited to be part of the festivities via phone and email. 850-414-1234 is the number to call, or you can send us an email, perspectives@wfsu.org. Well, the invasion saw tens of thousands of troops landing on five stretches of the Normandy coastline on that day 75 years ago. Codenamed Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juno, and Sword Beaches, the amphibious landings, codenamed Operation Overlord, were preceded by an extensive bombing campaign to damage German defenses. In total, about 7,000 ships took part in the invasion. That included 1,213 warships, 4,127 landing craft, some 24,000 Allied troops were also dropped behind enemy lines shortly after midnight on the day of the invasion, and 132,000 men landed on the beaches. On D-Day alone, 4,414 Allied troops were confirmed dead, with more than 9,000 wounded or missing. That from Matthew Robinson of CNN. That is what happened 75 years ago today. And we want to hear your D-Day stories, a relation, a friend of a relation, a tale that you may have heard someone tell that you would like to relate to us, a family member perhaps who was involved in that operation or knew someone who was. Because we have two gentlemen here who are going to share their stories and thoughts about it all. We say hi to Matt Kemp, Chief Organizer of Honor Flight Tallahassee and also part of the EMS group here in Leon County. Matt, so good to see you, sir.
Good morning. Good to see you, too.
And joining you on this D-Day is Val Fraley, Commander of Salisbridge's Post 13 American Legion over at Lake Ella. Glad you could find us, and welcome, Val.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
Mac, on the last honor flight, which was just a few weeks ago,
yes.
How many World War II vets were on that particular jaunt from Tallahassee up to Washington, D.C., and the various memorials up there?
Sadly, we're down to four.
Oh.
The first two flights we took, this, of course, was our seventh flight, but the first two flights were 100% World War II veterans, and then it tapered off to about half along the way, but we don't have a lot left, and we did have several more sign up that were just weren't able to go because of medical reasons or other things that came up. But we did take two 99-year-old veterans on this flight, and that was pretty amazing.
For those folks who are not aware of Honor Flight, it is a nationwide program. For 7 years, we've had it here in Leon County. And once a year, you load up that plane, and away y'all go, and each of the veterans has, I guess you could call, a special pal who goes with them to make it an even more interesting and certainly more supportive kind of experience for them.
Yeah, we have a guardian that goes with them that helps push the wheelchair, carry oxygen, help them get meals, because this isn't a standard trip to Washington, D.C. A lot of these veterans are obviously older. Usually they range between 70 and 100. And we take 80 of those. We take a lot of wheelchairs. We have paramedics. We have doctors to attend to them all day long. So there's a lot that goes on this trip. It's not a typical AAA trip to Washington, D.C.
Boy, that's for sure. And every time that you have, like, the Veterans Day breakfast out of Post 13, Commander, I recall back in the day, it was pretty solid participation by World War II vets, and y'all are down now to just a handful too, right?
We're down to a handful, but there's two of them that are just absolutely amazing, and they're there every Tuesday dancing with the swing band. One of them made nine landings in the South Pacific, Edmund, and Eddie Wheel was with the 8th Air Force in England. And he's there. He'll be 99 this year. Edmund will be 100.
Oh, my Lord, and still there cutting the rug with the swing band on Tuesday nights then.
Well, it's a little slower, but the rug's rolled up.
Well, yeah, it's not exactly death metal. You know, these guys have a nice kind of gentle tempo that they work on, but that's still really neat.
And that's part of the history of the swing band, too. They used to practice at one of the assisted living places. And a couple of World War II veterans that were members of the post suggested that they do their practice on Tuesdays. That's when they did it. And do it at the post. And for now, for 29 years plus, they've been doing it at the post every Tuesday night.
And it's a wonderful place, as we had mentioned on the phone yesterday, Val. Great acoustics there, Ken. Vouch for that personally here. From the Associated Press, the U.S. entered World War II after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Of course, Germany declared war on the U.S. in support of its ally. And to ease pressure on his homeland, Soviet leader Joseph Stalin had increasingly leaned on the U.S. and Britain to open a second front on Germany. And you recall, at the beginning of the hostilities there, the Russians and the Germans were allies. Hitler and Stalin had a non-aggression pact that they were working off. That didn't last long. Well, anyway, the competition between the Allies and the Soviets effectively set the stage for the Cold War lines that defined Europe for the next five decades and possibly right up to this very day. So for those folks who maybe didn't live anywhere close to that time period, it is hard to imagine just how significant all of this was. And Matt Kemp, what were some of the tales that you've heard from some of the veterans that have gone along on Honor Flight or others of your acquaintance about their take on why this was such an immense changer of history in this world?
It really has more of an impact, and it really affects every single American today and most people across the world, because If the Allies had not won that battle, if all of these soldiers, all these veterans had not placed everything on the line, things would be very different for us today. The Honor Flight Group is one of their things that they say that that these veterans, if they had not during World War II served and sacrificed so much, that we may not even be speaking English today here in the United States. So this was something that was on a larger scale than anything that we have going on today. It was a very small country, which was Germany, but it was on the verge of taking over virtually the entire world and controlling everything. And these men and women were going in. You know, most of them had never been out of the state or sometimes even the county that they lived in before, and they were suddenly on a ship going overseas to lands unknown, to areas that they were not familiar with, and it was quite an undertaking.
And at the beginning of World War II, I remember, Commander Val, that it did not look too great for the Allies. Particularly the Blitzkrieg that swept through Europe, the bombings on England. If the U.S. had not gotten in, as Max said, it would have been a very different set of circumstances. And it was tough for the U.S. to get into this conflict, given the fact that the logistics of going across the Atlantic were mind-boggling.
Well, it started with Neville Chamberlain coming back and saying, "Peace in our time." And, of course, that wasn't peace at all. And then when Hitler started his game and his role, he knew where he wanted to go. And he had some generals that had paid attention to not only what Sherman did in a march to the sea, but what Black Jack Pershing did in order to help win World War I. And that is, you have your stuff first, and you get there first, and you go around something if you want to take it instead of going through it. And that's what they did. When they rolled in, that Blitzkrieg rolled in. Even later, after this and the Battle of the Bulge, he got the best tank in the world at that time. That Tiger II was one heck of a tank. And they rolled in right up there near Flanders. And they were rolling so well, but they forgot something. oil, petrol, that's what they called it over there, gasoline. And they'd capture some sometimes, but they never got enough. But they understood what to do. And part of that, they had learned, the people in the United States, fortunately, had learned that you need to be ready to go before you go. Now, we had been arming the Brits and the French and anybody else later on, even the Russians, with everything that they needed. We were sending every kind of armament over. And the folks that we had in the States, the few that were regular army and building up a little bit, were learning to shoot with weapons that we had. In World War I, they trained with sticks. They went over and they used nothing but French and British machine guns, tanks, artillery. We didn't have anything.
That's right. And I remember that the that French excuse for a machine gun, the Chouchou, that was absolutely horrific. That was probably one of the worst pieces of armament ever designed by people.
Well, Germans did a pretty good job with their ability to use machine guns, especially in World War I, because they knew how to do crossing lines of fire, and that just wiped out cavalry in nothing fat. So the cavalry couldn't go. I mean, it was dog food real quick.
Yet, there were still horses in World War
I. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. World War I, they had horses. In fact, they launched in 1915 two major attacks with horses. And then didn't learn and did it again in 1916. I mean, it's kind of dumb, but the generals weren't always known for their intelligence.
Talking about D-Day, do you have any memories? Do you have any tales that you have gleaned over the years from family members or friends? Love to hear them. 850-414-1234 on this special D-Day edition of Perspectives. We'll be right back. You are in tune to Perspectives, and we have Matt Kemp from Honor Flight Tallahassee and Val Fraley from Sauls Bridges Post 13 American Legion here with us on this special D-Day edition of the program. And you are always welcome to tune it in via internet after it is no longer on the radio waves. You just go to WFSU.org. You click on the radio icon. That'll bring down a menu of programs, and one of those will be Perspectives. We are archive the shows, try to have them up within 24 hours of when it actually is on the radio. Michael Phillips of the Wall Street Journal wrote this. Eisenhower's little-known letter to his wife Mamie reveals the Supreme Allied Commander juggling martial and marital duties at the same time. Starting tomorrow, General Eisenhower wrote on June 5th, 1944, I have a series of trips that will last without interruption from 6 to 10 days. If you have a lapse in arriving letters, don't jump at the conclusion that I don't want to write. I'll simply have no opportunity to pick up a pen. Understatement that. He kept the handwritten letter vague, apparently to avoid giving away war plans should it fall into German hands. He may even have mentioned his series of trips to persuade the enemy that the landing was still a week or more off. And of course, the next day, the invasion began. That little break in the weather. And he said, go. And it happened. How many folks at Sauls Bridges Post were part of the invasion at D-Day? Val, anyone?
I don't know of any right now. Nobody's confessed to me that they were part of the landings on that day. I know that they had planned, as you heard there from Eisenhower, that June the 5th was going to be the go date, but they had a little problem with too much wind and a lot of seas, and it wasn't going to work. So they decided to start, and they went go the next day. The amazing thing is that was, as you've already read, the largest invasion ever on a beachhead anywhere. And the deceptions that had been going on in England, you got to remember, you're within a rock's toss almost of where all the Germans were. And they were listening and watching, and they had folks everywhere reading every newspaper, and they were planting stories in those newspapers. They had a king that was really doing a lot of deception at the time. And he was running around visiting these guards and going even all the way up to Scapa Flow. And now, I mean, that's way the heck up there. And so suddenly now the Germans are thinking, maybe they're going to invade Norway. And then there was always what Hitler thought, it's going to be Calais. It's going to be Calais. And he even was thinking that after a day or two of what has happened. They were afraid to wake him up that morning because they knew what was going on. These guys were looking with their binoculars out over from Normandy, and they're seeing, they're here. And then about that time, fortunately, their communications got well cut because of those paratroopers that came in. That was one of the main things to do, cut the communications. And they did. And fortunate. Otherwise, they had beaucoups of those tanks just waiting to come up there. But they wouldn't allow them. They didn't. No, no, we're holding those for when it's going to really happen. And that's the way Hitler thought. You see, he had done so magnificently with his seat of the pants opinions and tactics that he had done all over with Poland, with going into France, Austria, all those places. He had seat of the pants decided which way to go, and he thought he was invincible.
And he was only a private in World War I, so it's not like he had great strategic insight into how to run a modern army.
Paper hanging doesn't get you very far.
And any stories out of honor flight participants, Mac, that kind of stand out at you, like Val was talking about? Anything from World War II, not just D-Day?
Yeah, one of the veterans, the first thing, these veterans, most of the veterans of all the wars, they really don't like to talk about these things. These were hard times. These were difficult times. They saw a lot of stuff that most people have never seen before. And it's tough for them to talk about it, but I've coaxed a few stories from some of them. And one of them is a gentleman. He actually landed on Omaha Beach. He still lives here in Tallahassee. He's a great guy. He's one of the most quiet, retiring, laid-back gentlemen you'll ever meet. But he landed on Omaha Beach, fought his way in to France, fought his way into Germany, and the main part of his story is that he was with his battalion was one of the groups that liberated one of the Holocaust camps in Germany, and that was a major part of his life. It has been since then, and he really didn't want to talk about it, but we kind of pushed him a little bit, and he just told us that when they got to that camp. The guards had fled, and so there was nobody there to stop them. So they went into the camp, and what they found was 1,500 people that were already dead inside the camp. There were another 1,500, he said, that were there that they realized they couldn't help and that were going to die within the next 3 days or so, and they did. But he said the bright side of it was there were about 2,500 people in that camp that they were able to help. And that's something, it's affected him his entire life. I mean, it's something that you don't just move on from, seeing suffering on such a massive scale as that. Now, the side story to that is that he, while they were stationed in a German town for a few weeks, there were a lot of orphans there, and he befriended an 8-year-old boy that was starving. And whenever they would go to mess, he would divide some of his food out and give it to this 8-year-old boy and fed him for a period of weeks. And of course, the little boy spoke German. He spoke English, so they couldn't directly converse, but they hung out together. And a few years ago, just 3 or 4 years ago, he went on a trip to Germany to that little town, and his son went with him. And it occurred to him, I should look for that little boy, because he had a picture of him and knew his first name. So the next year, his son said, Dad, we ought to go back to that Germantown visit. What his dad didn't know is that he had arranged for the entire town in Germany to come to the town hall and meet this veteran and thank him. And while he was there and all these people clapping and cheering, they brought out this man that had been this 8-year-old boy that he had befriended over 70-something years ago. And it was just an amazing it was something that with all of these horrible, horrible things that he saw during World War II, this was such an amazing, incredible story that he was able to personally help save at least one 8-year-old German boy.
What a reconnection.
Absolutely amazing.
Well, Mac brought up something here, Val, that before we knew there were such things as PTSD, before there was therapy and all of these modern kinds of ways to deal with traumatized folks, 25 years before the folks hit the beaches, there was an American Legion in this country in the wake of World War I. And that kind of provided some of that therapy, if you will, occasionally the liquid variety, but also the camaraderie, the fact that there are people here who have been through the same kind of things I have. I can talk to them. They understand me, and we can kind of work this out.
That's why they, I guess, came and became so many of the different little at first, they thought they'd call them billets, but then they decided that wasn't the best, so they named them posts. And all the posts really started, and actually some people will go back to the first Paris Caucus to find a birthday for the American Legion, which was March the 15th, 1919. But actually, they didn't get really organized until they got to the St. Louis Caucus, which was later. American Legion Post 13 was first named Saul's American Legion Post 13 because Saul's was the first veteran from Leon County that was killed in World War I. So we were Saul's, and we got our name and our date of becoming a post on June the 9th. 1919. In fact, we're going to have a birthday party on Sunday. And folks are welcome to come down there between 3 and 5. There will be a birthday cake. There's going to be some history that folks are going to go through. Pictures. They've found lots of pictures of these folks. I've got one that's on there at my desk, and it shows one end of the post, which incidentally has never been anything but our home. It was started by a guy named Anderson who had a dairy there, and he was building a dance pavilion, and he abandoned it after he got the basic foundation in and some of the beams for the floors because he was reluctant. He said, I don't think there's going to be anybody that wants to go that far out in the country to go dancing. So he abandoned it, and the American Legionnaires found out about it, and he donated the starting of that pavilion plus the land, some of the lots, majority of them that we're on right now, and he donated them to the guys. There was a bunch of Legionnaires that were finishing up Lake Talican and the dam and everything out there. They had plenty of hardwood as well as pine, and you can imagine what a 1924 truck looks like, and they commandeered one of them and loaded it up and bring it up to the post, dump it out, and on the weekends they'd come there and build the post. There's one of the pictures on my desk shows them just after they had finished, well, at least partially after they'd finished, and these guys are in front of one of the fireplaces. There's no inside paneling. There's no inside ceiling. Instead, it's just the beams, trusses going up with hangy-down lights and hangy-down fans, and there's your air conditioner, there's your heat, and there's your lights, and that's what it was. And somebody looked at that with me the other day and said, but those guys are so young. Well, guess they would be. They're not a lot, a bunch of old folks like we are today down there. But what we call PSTD and all those other wonderful terms that have little letters in front of them was called shell shock. And that's what everybody went with, shell shock. And they figured, well, all you have to do is live long enough and you'll get away from it. Doesn't always happen. Sometimes you have to either bury it somewhere or talk through it. And like Max said, they don't always want to talk about it. They don't always want to remember it that way.
That is true, and it was not just endemic to that particular generation, although it was still the days when you didn't talk about that kind of thing. Hey, that's over. You move on, and you don't deal with what might be lurking down there below. I know my dad, who was in the Pacific Theater. He was in the Navy, and he was on one of these monster LSTs, although I think they had a different designation for them because they could carry a bunch of tanks. And he was quartermaster on one of those during the attack on Iwo Jima. And, of course, the Japanese had the high ground for Mount Suribachi, and they could rain down all kinds of death and destruction, not only on the beach, but also the landing craft that were bringing in the troops and the materiel and all that kind of thing. So he got out with his life, but he would not talk about that. Some of the guys he would. I remember so-and-so, and he'd have a funny story about it. But to what he actually went through, particularly when at any moment that entire vessel could go up with all of the ammo and the gasoline and everything else that was aboard and taking everyone out with it, he would not broach that subject until probably a year and a half before he died, when my little brother finally sat him down in front of a video camera and said, "Dad, you're going to tell your story." My baby brother was big enough to enforce that and Dad did, and it all came out. And remarkable, remarkable stories. Do you have a remarkable story? We'd love to hear from you. 850-414-1234. Doesn't have to be about D-Day in particular, but any real battle tales that you've heard from family or friends, because that's what we're talking about here on Perspectives. Here's one. This is from Naomi Bisserby of the Wall Street Journal. "This year, only a few dozen American D-Day vets are returning to Normandy." As you said, Mac Kemp, we're kind of losing them here. Scott Desjardins, who is superintendent of the Normandy American Cemetery and Memorial, which honors American troops who died in Europe during World War II. "The average age of D-Day vets returning to Normandy this year, we saw some of them on the TV coverage this morning, is 96. Less than 4% of World War II veterans are still alive, and few can muster that strength to travel. Although, again, one can jump out of a plane and hit the same spot that they did 75 years ago back behind the lines in Normandy." That was quite a tale. Either of you guys ever do parachute jumping?
No, I'm not jumping out of a good airplane. I'm not going to do that.
And see, I can't picture you doing that, Val, for some reason.
I can't picture me doing it either. Edmund Stedman is the one that the man at the post that comes every Tuesday night. And he was in the Navy. He trained at Great Lakes long before Camp Gordon Johnson was available. So he knew about driving those boats to the beach because the Navy trained him up north. And I asked him one time, I've only gotten a very few little stories out of him. He's talked to several others with World War II history and things like that. But one of the things he told me about, and I asked him, I said, "Which was the worst of all those landings? Which was absolutely the worst?" And he said, "Iwo Jima. Iwo was the toughest." And he said, "I could be hunkered down, and these bullets were winging by my ears like bumblebees." And he paraphrased what another guy said. "It was just like you could pick them out of the air because they were going by your ears so close." And he was a beachmaster there, if I'm not mistaken. And as part of that, later on, he was responsible for trying to identify those that were no longer with us. And which goes with what? And that would have to be more than I'd ever want to do either. He was good friends with Boots Thomas. Now, Boots Thomas is from Monticello. If you go to Monticello on this side of town, there's a memorial there to Boots Thomas. Boots Thomas was a Marine that was friends with Edmund, and because they were from the same area. And as a sergeant, he was given a flag to take to the top of Suribachi, the first raising of a flag up there that was photographed by a Marine Corps photographer. What happened is they shelled the heck out of Suribachi, and all these guys that were not very much interested in coming out during the shelling. And evidently they did it long enough, they probably didn't get much sleep. So the next day, when they were after the shelling was over, he and a platoon went to the top easy, and they found a piece of pipe up there, and they put up that flag.
And that's the one that...
And that was the first one. Okay. You can get a copy of that in the archives.
And it's right, but it's not the one that made the... Well, we'll have that story on the other side of this break rapidly coming up here as we're recalling D-Day, and also anything else that you remember being told about World War II. We'll continue that discussion right here on Perspectives. We are back on Perspectives and finishing that story of the raising of the flag over Mount Suribachi at Iwo Jima. Now, the first one you were just saying, Val, when the first time that the guys got up there with a flag, it was a piddly little thing, and it wasn't very photogenic, was it?
Well, according to the guys down there in the bay that were doing the shelling, and there were some big ships down there, one of the guys with a lot of brass looked up there and said, that flag's too small. And here, take this big one and take it up there. Bring me that small one. And, of course, the guys were smart enough to know that take up the big one and the small one did not come back down to that brass guy. But that's when it was a photograph that won a Pulitzer Prize and is now the basis for the Marine Corps Memorial in Washington, D.C.
Right there at the entrance to Arlington National Cemetery, and we have all seen that image thousands and thousands of times. Well, that's why those guys were straining, because that's a big frickin' flag. Those things are heavy. They're crying out loud. Oh, so what do we do from here on in, Max, since that greatest generation, the World War II guys, are taking their leave of us at a depressingly rapid rate here? Does Honor Flight continue?
Yes, yes. We are going to continue to take. We do still have World War II guys that are signed up for our next flight, but we are also taking Korean War veterans and we're taking Vietnam veterans. So there's a lot of veterans to be honored yet. Our job is not over, and we want to continue to do that because we want everybody to feel like, well, one thing, remember these memorials, many of them, like particularly World War II, was not finished until 2005. So by the time that memorial was finished, most of these World War II guys were already too old to get there. And when I say guys, there's guys and girls. We've taken them all. We've also taken a lot of veterans from services that people don't think about, people that served in the Coast Guard. Those were, sure enough, World War II active folks that need to be remembered. We've even taken Merchant Marine. And Merchant Marine, there was no way the war effort could have continued without those guys. And they were sailing without guns and without protection a lot of times. It was a scary thing for all of them. So there's a lot of people from that generation that we want to recognize still. But we do definitely want to recognize the Korea and the Vietnam veterans also.
Well, I think there's only been, 16 years since the Constitution was ratified that the United States has not been involved in some kind of armed conflict with someone. So I don't think we'll ever have a lack of veterans. But one thing that I've noticed, Val Fraley, is that organizations like yours and VFW, AMVETS and all that have gone through a lot of changes, too, over the years with the change in our veterans. One thing that you guys have that probably would have been anathema to the the original generation of vets is what goes on now with the Second Judicial Circuit. You have those folks out there, homeless vets come in, try to hook them up with housing, and if they got something on their record, try to get that cleaned up and link them up with whatever services are available. And that's something that you guys do every week at the Post.
Well, it's fortunate that they started a stand down here in Tallahassee, copying what had gone on for a long time in San Diego. And as they've gone into the stand down, which was basically to lure, if you will, the veterans out of the woods that were homeless. And now we're down to not too many homeless, but a lot of them that are potentially homeless. And for that reason, they still have the stand down once a year. And out of an outgrowth of that was helping them with their legal problems. And that put together a bunch of lawyers that pro bono will help veterans that have need, well, for instance, to get their driver's license that they've lost. You want to get a job? You don't get a job without a driver's license. So they help them get their driver's license. Sometimes there's a cost involved. So far, the folks here in the state of Florida won't give you a driver's license without paying for it. But as far as the legal kinds of things and the judge's fees, they're usually waived. So, in fact, those guys could use some money if anybody's got any extra laying around. And that meets at the Post every Thursday afternoon from 3 to 5. Every Thursday, pro bono for veterans, legal services. And the state comes along, puts up a table there, and if you're looking for a job, there's employment service too. This isn't bad. And one of the fellows that had gotten his law degree last year, we swore him into the bar right there at the Post. And that was a very nice thing. We enjoyed doing that. Had our state commander there, too. It was great.
That is a very big deal. But again, that's changing the whole concept. Growing up, I remember my hometown Legion. It was Faraday Post 24. I can recall it like it was yesterday. And the main service that was offered, again, with the camaraderie and the ability for vets to get together, but it was pretty much quaffing a whole bunch of cold ones and BSing about the news of the day, or maybe every now and then you get a little memory that would come popping out from the actual active duty of these guys. But that was more liquid therapy than anything else. And again, you all were doing much more than you did back in the day.
Well, back in the day when that was the liquid therapy, it seems like the fisherman whose arms get farther and farther apart every time he talks about what he caught. We had some of that with some of the veterans, too. And it's amazing when you get the guy that tells you some of the about wonderful tales that he had during Korea, but he was in North Africa, and he was out there where there was nothing but sand dunes. And I remember that. It was right in the middle of a eucalyptus forest. A little different. But you call their hand on it, and if you know them. And it's all right. Everybody understands. Because you can get elaborate. And folks often do. But it's those that have really been under fire that don't elaborate. Yeah. They want to minimize. Because when they remind themselves, it comes back way deep inside of them. It seems like thoughts of home and living at home can allay the fears that you had back then. And the fears that you have now as you remember what you did and what you saw and the buddies you left behind.
You mentioned that, Matt Kemp, when it came to the gentleman who was on the honor flight who was part of the liberation of the camp. And that is a horrific image that none of us will ever be able to conjure up in our own brains, even in our worst nightmares, that How can anyone survive combat unscathed, really?
You know, I don't think that they can. survive unscathed, but they can overcome it and go back to friends and family. And, you know, there's a lot of things today as far as counseling and all those different things that are available. I think all that's helpful, that you recognize that these things are stressful. But having said that, you know, even these World War II guys, it was when they came back from the war, that was a war that everybody in the United States was involved in. And when these guys came back, what people don't realize is they didn't come back all at one time to ticker tape parades. They came back one at a time over a period of weeks and months after the war, being released one at a time. And when they came home, they simply took off their uniform and went to work. That's what they did. That's what the expectation was, because you were surrounded by so many other veterans that had been in that conflict, and everybody at home had played a role in that conflict, whether it was collecting recycle or, you know, being rationed for gasoline and food. There were just so many things, and everybody played a part of some type. You know, I mean, many Americans that weren't over there were here building all that armament that needed to be used over there. So there were so many people that played a part that when they came home, there wasn't anybody to lean on. You just had to go back to work and do what you had to do. And a lot of people just kind of pushed all their feelings aside about how they felt about what they had seen. One other story I'll tell you that one of the veterans, this was very special. He hadn't told anybody, not even his kids, he told me. The only one he had ever told the story was his wife. He had gone over, had gone into Germany, was at the Battle of the Bulge. And the Battle of the Bulge was the last big push by the Germans to try to turn the war around when things weren't going so well. And they were trapped. Americans and British troops were trapped by the Germans. And the German commander sent a word to the American commander, either you surrender or we're going to annihilate all of you. And the German commander had a one-word response, which was nuts. And the German commander did not even understand what that meant. But basically what it was is, we're not giving up. And so this guy, he had become platoon leader of his group because his lieutenant had been killed the day before, because it was just constant, massive bombardment. So they found a small chateau where there was a barn. And in that barn, there was a little bit of a basement area where they had kept food stuff down there to try to keep things cool. So all of his men huddled down in there, and he said there were 34 of them. And during the night, a bomb, a large bomb, what he called, described as a screaming Mimi, what made a direct hit on that barn. And this gentleman was blown out of that basement, out into the area between the farmhouse and the barn. And he was in a pile of debris, laying head down with his feet up in the air in the debris, with his boots sticking out of the debris. And it happened to be another guy that was sitting next to him that happened to be from Lake City, was laying in the same position next to him. So after this horrific explosion, people came in. The other troops came in to see if there were, you know, if anybody was hurt or what was going on. And they found this gentleman and the guy from Lake City, and they were both severely injured. And they got them to an aid station until they could finally get out of there. But as this gentleman talked to me, tears were just rolling down his face. And he said, the terrible thing about that day is that the other 32 men that were in that basement with us all died. And he said something like that is just not easy to get over. And he said, I've never told that story to anyone except my wife. So I felt so very honored that he decided to tell that story to me. And this was after he had been on honor flight, and he felt like that he had been honored, had been appreciated. And after all those years, he finally felt like he was able to tell that story. And I was so very privileged to be able to hear it.
Val Fraley, that connects directly to something that you said in those incredible remarks that you made during the Post's Memorial Day observance over at Oakland Cemetery in the veterans thing about the guys, mostly guys, who fought in the Vietnam era and why they fought.
Well, in Vietnam, you had news persons on the ground, some of them with the units. And they'd be right there, and of course they always showed up right after, because the helicopter would fly them in, and they'd all gang up to talk to whoever it is that was still standing and come up with some of the most ridiculous questions. You can see them today and as they interview folks. These guys came back, the ones that did. There were no honor flights. There were no honor guards. There were no bands. There were no parades. There was nobody to meet them at the plane when they came home. Instead, they'd come back two and three with buddies that they'd bled with, realizing that they had gone to war because their country had asked them to, and because they felt impelled by God to go. And when they came home, they realized they'd only fought for each other, because they certainly weren't honored by their country.
Perhaps the best thing that we can bring from the experience that we're having today in the commemoration of D-Day is to bring all of those folks who have fought for either their band of brothers, their flag, their country, all together into one group to be honored and appreciated by the rest of us who did not go and fight for whatever reason. Matt Kemp with Honor Flight Tallahassee, Val Fraley with Salzbridge's Post 13 American Legion, and happy anniversary to the Post and to the American Legion. Thank you guys for coming on Perspectives on a very special day, and one that we hope to always remember. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Perspectives produced by WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee, and we have a group of folks we want to thank back behind the glass today. We have the incredible Evan Rossi pushing all the buttons, Lydell Rawls on the interconnects, and I'm Tom Flanagan. You know, later this month, Tallahassee is going to be bidding farewell to Temple Israel Rabbi Jack Romberg. And before he leaves our community, where he's made a considerable amount of impact over the years, we wanted to get his thoughts on things like civil discourse and cross-cultural understanding and simply getting along better with each other. He may bring a friend or two along, too. We'll see if that happens. But we'll be talking about it next week right here on Perspectives. Have a good D-Day. Take care.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcasts. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.